nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So what we've been talking about in this module, which is the last five, six lectures, basically talks about techniques that you can use to automatically perform two-level minimization, right? So we haven't been studying the code, but these are the algorithms that are implemented in the tools that actually perform two-level minimization, right? So we have been, so we are very much into the core of design automation. The remark I made, though, which might have led you to ask the question, was that two-level implementations themselves are not necessarily efficient for all functions, right? However, two-level minimization is used as a kernel, as a step within the larger context of multi-level minimization, right? It may not be apparent right now, but when we get to talking about multi-level minimization, we will see that any general multi-level circuit can be thought of as basically a network of these super gates, where each gate is like a two-level sub-circuit in itself. And two-level minimization is going to be used to minimize, to optimize those chunks of the larger circuit, right? So the algorithms that we talked about, both the exact and heuristic, are exactly, those are precisely what are implemented, or some of the popular algorithms implemented in two-level minimization tools. Right. And that should be reinforced, hopefully, once you look at the code of Espresso. It's part of the next homework. So to recap, we've talked about just a overall summary, recapping what we've talked about in this module. Exact two-level minimization can be performed using either exact algorithms or heuristic algorithms. Exact algorithms are guaranteed to give you the correct answer. And the foundation of all exact algorithms is based on two key steps: the generation of all primes of a function and selection of a minimum subset of primes, right? And both of these steps essentially originate from the Quine-McCluskey algorithm. So the very basic structure of all exact minimizers are Quine-McCluskey, except that in order to make Quine-McCluskey something that you can implement as a computer program and something that will scale to larger functions, we had to talk about several concepts. Those concepts included branch and bound as a method of solving the minimum subset selection or covering problem, right? And in order to talk about, to improve the efficiency of branch and bound, we talked about optimality preserving pruning techniques, things like row and column dominance and equivalence, right? That would reduce the size of the covering table before you started branch and bound without sacrificing optimality. Concept of essential primes, again, without sacrificing optimality. For branch and bound, we talked about maximal independent set as an effective bound method to compute the bound. Branch and bound will work and it'll be optimal for no matter what bound you use. However, a more effective bound will reduce the amount of time you spend in branch and bound. So we talked about maximal independent set. We did not talk as much about branching heuristics. This is something that, I'm going to leave to you for you as homework to read either from Rudell's thesis or by looking at the Espresso code to look at what are some of the popular branching heuristics used in practice. In order to generate primes, we've talked about iterated consensus. So iterated consensus improves upon the prior technique, the tabular method, in that you do not need to start with a minterm canonical form, right, which is likely to be exponential. You can start off with any cover. Hopefully you have a compact two-level representation of the function to start off with. And starting with that, iterated consensus can generate all the primes. And we've talked about scaling the branch and bound algorithm by creating a compressed covering table. In other words, rather than generating a large covering table and then eliminating equivalent rows, in practice, equivalent rows are the biggest source of redundancy in the covering table. So what we talked about was basically generating the covering table in practice such that by construction, you only have one row representing a set of equivalent rows. Right. So this is sort of a summary of what we've talked about in exact minimization. In heuristic two-level minimization, we've talked about the Espresso algorithm, which is based on the strategy of iterative improvement. Start off with a solution, apply weak optimization steps, weaker than the steps used in exact minimization. However, apply them iteratively and try to escape local minima. So the key steps in Espresso that we've talked about are iteratively performed are expand, iterate, redundant, and reduce, right? And these are iteratively performed to escape local minima and give you a reasonably high-quality solution. We've also briefly mentioned the use of efficient data structures, specifically the positional cube notation, in order to efficiently encode the cubeless lists of cubes, which are basically the primary data structure used in Espresso and all the operations that you perform upon them. Now, another key concept that we used that essentially I've separated out because we've applied it in multiple contexts is the unate recursive paradigm. Right? It's just a way of performing various operations on Boolean functions by recursively dividing them through cofactoring. Right? And using, taking advantage of quicker techniques to that you can use when you hit special cases. Right? So, unate recursive paradigm, for instance, was used in compressed covering table generation in exact minimization. It was also used in the complement step of Espresso, which I've not included here. It's not part of the inner loop. However, the complement step, which is initially performed in Espresso, also uses the unate recursive paradigm. Okay. So, for those of you who are interested in looking at the further developments beyond what we've talked about in class, here are some of the key developments. We haven't talked about BDDs in detail yet. However, from the first module, you know that BDDs or binary decision diagrams are compact ways of, implicit ways of representing Boolean functions. So it turns out that the covering table also can be implicitly represented as a BDD. Okay. And, so some researchers have explored in the mid-90s, explored ways of using BDDs to implicitly represent and more efficiently perform, solve the covering problem. There is a couple of techniques that have been proposed for better bound computation and more advanced pruning techniques than what we saw in class. Notably, there's the paper by Liao and Devdas that talks about using linear programming for computing lower bounds instead of the maximal independent set. Later on, there was also a advancement in the generation of primes. Essentially, there are some primes that you can upfront say will never appear in the minimal solution. So if you can identify such primes, you can not even generate them in the first step of prime generation, right? That way, the number of columns in the covering table will be reduced, right? The compression that we talked about when we talked about covering table compression was compression in terms of number of rows, which certainly in practice tends to be the larger bottleneck. But once you address that, it also helps if you can have as few columns as possible. And this is one way of doing that. There's a couple of overview papers which give you a nice, the first one just talks about the theoretical complexity of this optimization problem of two-level logic minimization. And the other one is a survey of all the techniques that have been proposed. So if you're interested in getting an overview, I'd encourage you to look at these techniques. What I'd like to do in the next several minutes is introduce you to a free piece of software called Logic Friday. This is freely available on the web. It's basically a graphical front end to Espresso and MIS, which are the two software packages that we will be using for some of the hands-on labs in this course, or the homeworks in this course, right? So the next homework, as I mentioned, is going to be based on Espresso. A couple of homeworks down, you'll be playing with SIS, which is a sequential enhanced version of MIS. From a combinational logic optimization perspective, it's essentially the same. So Logic Friday basically gives you a way to interface to these tools by entering simple Boolean functions, optimizing them, and looking at the output. So you can start off the truth table, look at the Boolean function in terms of a logic equation, and actually draw a gate-level diagram of the same thing. So as I said, you can enter and view a logic function either as a truth table, equation, or gate diagram to prevent blow up when you view the truth table. They actually limit it to functions of 16 inputs and 16 outputs. This is not a limitation of Espresso or MIS. It's just a limitation of the front end. But still, nevertheless, for you to get an intuition of how these algorithms and tools work, it's still a very useful software package to play with. And you can minimize, perform two-level minimization both with FAST, which is heuristic minimization, and exact minimization. So that corresponds to exactly what we've talked about in class. You can also automatically generate a multi-level gate diagram using gates from a library. We haven't yet talked about it. We will be discussing it when we talk about multi-level optimization and technology mapping. And you can also perform a number of other useful functions. Okay. Without describing it further, I think I'd like to go ahead and show you how the tool works. So it has to be a Windows PC. You can freely download and install it on a Windows PC. So in this case, you can start off by specifying a new truth table, logic equation, or gate diagram. So I'm going to, for the first example, I'm actually going to start off by specifying a new truth table. It asks you how many inputs the function has and how many outputs the function has. It automatically names them. You can, of course, change the names if you wish. We'll go with the defaults here. So it starts off with this four input function, and all the entries in the truth table in the output column are initialized to zero. So you can just click on them and change them. In this case, I picked some entries to change to one. You can also change them to don't cares by clicking twice, as I've done right there. So let's just now randomly pick a few entries and make them ones. And then you can perform various operations. Before I do that, I need to truth table submit. If you hit enter, it takes you back to this main window. It has accepted the truth table. And it also gives you the sum of products expression corresponding to the truth table out here. So now what you can do is perform various operations. So we're going to start minimizing it. In this case, it's a small function, so exact minimization should not be a problem. So we do exact minimization, and you can see that the minimized sum of products expression is shown here, which consists of four product terms in this case. And the product terms are also given here in the on the left-hand side. So you can do that, and then you can map this to gates if you wish. You can choose what gates you would like to use in your library. And in this case, we are just, for simplicity, using an inverter, two-input NAND, two-input NOR. We'll stick with the default. You can feel free to change that and play with it. And you can see in this case, using techniques that we've not yet talked about, it has started off with a two-level function and then expanded it into a multi-level implementation or multi-level network of gates. We will be talking about how this happens, but for now, you can still just play with it and see how this works, right? The initial minimization step that I ran previously is exactly what we talked about in class, the exact two-level minimization. Basically uses Espresso as the backend. You can do the same thing by entering a function in the form of a logic equation. I tend to find that a little more convenient. So in this case, I'm just going to say z equals, so z is the output of my function, a. This symbol here represents the logic XOR. How many inputs do I have now? 8. Let's enter a 10 input XOR. Okay, it tells me that the equation must be terminated with a semicolon, which I'm going to do now. And it creates the truth table. So the 10 input XOR, this is basically the truth table for the 10 input XOR. As you can see, it has not listed the zero entries. It's only listed the one entries in the truth table, which is sufficient. And by the way, in the top window out here, it retains the previous function. So you can always switch between multiple examples or multiple functions that you're working with. So we'll get back to the 10 input XOR here. And you can see that the truth table has been automatically constructed. Now, let's try to perform minimization here of this function, two-level minimization. It tells you that exact minimization may be slow. By the way, when you're performing minimization at any point in time, you can cancel it, and it's going to give you the best solution it's seen thus far. So that's a useful thing to have. I'm going to go ahead and run fast minimization in this case. Any guesses on what to expect? Let's run it. Oops. What do we see? Tenement XOR has this huge two-level implementation, right? So that should tell you why two-level minimization is not really good for arithmetic circuits and data paths, right? XOR-like functions have, what is the minimum, if you think of the XOR functions, what is the Karnaugh map of an XOR function? What does it look like? Yeah, you're in the right direction. The diagonals are ones, but what else? So let's look at a two-input XOR or four-input XOR. Might be a little better. Okay, so the function we are trying to draw the K-map for is x1, xor, x2. Right? Looks like a checkerboard, right? Alternating squares of black and white, right? What's the problem with this pattern? Can any two minterms be combined into a larger cube? No. So the minimum two-level implementation basically will be using the minterms, right? Enumerating all the minterms. That's a problem, right? That's why XOR-based functions and arithmetic circuits certainly are very common examples of functions that use XORs are based on XORs are not amenable to two-level implementation. It doesn't mean that they cannot use design automation or logic synthesis at all. It's just that two-level minimization doesn't work well on them. Okay. Now, going back to Logic Friday, another interesting thing you could do is to look at the logic expression as product of sums instead of sum of products, and we can do this. You can always convert it to product of sums. And unfortunately, that does not help either. So you can see that, you know, the product of sums also is kind of large for the, equally large, essentially, for the XOR. Okay. But, you can also factor this expression into a factored form, which is much more compact, fortunately. Right? In this case, you've taken the two-level expression and taken out common sub-expressions. And so this is a more arbitrary Boolean formula. Right? Where you have common sub-expressions and you're using parentheses to kind of interleave all the Boolean operations and or in this case, and using the parentheses to specify the order. So, a factored formula directly can be translated into a multi-level circuit. So, a multi-level circuit certainly is much more compact in the case of the XOR. But still not necessarily the right way to implement an XOR. Okay? Alright. So, just wanted to pick that to example. To, you know, also illustrate the need for talking about multi-level minimization and just mention that there are some classes of functions for which two-level minimization doesn't necessarily work. But Logic Friday, you know, is an interesting tool. I'd strongly encourage you to download it, play with it if you can, and hopefully it'll help you understand some of the concepts that we talk about in class better. What it does not do is allow you to directly select the command line options of the tools, Espresso and MIS. So for that reason, for the next homework, you probably will have to run the command line version yourself. Okay, so this is probably not going to be, you won't be able to get away just by using Logic Friday for the homework, but nevertheless, it's useful to play around just to get a nice intuition of what happens with different functions. Any questions? Okay. All right. Today we'll also start a new module. This is on Boolean satisfiability. So this is sort of a detour because in two-level minimization we've been talking about the synthesis facet of design automation, right? Remember, synthesis, verification, and analysis are the three major facets. we've been talking about synthesis. We're taking a detour here, and the reason is so that you have the right background to get started on your course projects, because the course projects, as I announced earlier in the semester, are going to be based on Boolean satisfiability. Okay, so I'll talk more about the course project specifically in a lecture or two, but the idea of talking about this upfront is so that you guys can, all of you can get started on your course projects as early as possible. You have the right background. Okay, so Boolean satisfiability is a very fundamental problem. It occurs in several different specific design automation problems. In a nutshell, the SAT problem can be stated as follows. Given a Boolean formula, find a variable assignment to all the variables in the formula, such that the formula evaluates to 1. Right? So you want the effective value of the formula to be 1, or prove, either find an assignment to the variables that makes the formula 1, or prove that no such assignment exists. Right? So you're asking the question, is this formula satisfiable, or can this formula ever evaluate to a 1? You can conclusively answer that in one of two ways. One is by giving an example, saying yes, it is satisfiable, and here is one example of set of assignments that make it logic 1. Or say that this is not satisfiable, and you also need to give a proof that the formula is not satisfiable. Right? So that is a satisfiability problem. It's stated very simply, but very challenging to solve. Why? Because if you have n variables, you have the combinatorial explosion of 2 power n possible assignments to the variables that you need to check. Right? Each of the variables can be 0 or 1, 2 power n combinations. So some of these combinations of variables, again, I'm representing the values of the variables and the combinations as a search tree here. Some of these leaves, each of the leaves of the search tree corresponds to one complete assignment of all the variables. And by assigning the variables, of course, the formula is either going to evaluate to 0 or 1. Right? So you can, in this case, we are correspondingly coloring the leaves as red or green, red representing that the formula evaluates to 0 under this assignment of variables, green representing the fact that the formula evaluates to 1. Okay. Although it sounds very simple, this is one of the most fundamental problems in computer science. Right? Those of you who have done 608 or maybe data structures or algorithms course in your undergrad, like ECE 368 here, know what NP completeness is. It's a class of decision problems in computer science that are considered to be among the hardest. In fact, any problem in this class of NP, right? NP refers to a class of computational problems where, given a solution, suppose somebody gives you a solution to the problem, you can check that it's a valid solution in polynomial type. It doesn't address the complexity of finding a solution. Given a solution, you can verify that it is a valid solution in polynomial type. Problems that satisfy that property are in the class NP. Right? Now, NP complete problems are problems that are in NP, but also they are special in the sense that all other problems in NP can be reduced to these problems, can be reformulated as these problems, and that reformulation is only going to take at most polynomial time. Polynomial in terms of some parameter that characterizes the size of the problem, right? In the case of the SAT formula, the number of variables is the complexity parameter, right? So, in a sense, these are the most fundamental problems in the class NP, because if you can solve them efficiently, then all the other problems in NP can be solved, converted in polynomial time to one of these problems, and then solved efficiently. Unfortunately, there is no known polynomial complexity solution to any of these NP complete problems. And although nobody knows for sure, this is one of the most fundamental problems in computer science, it is believed that no polynomial time solution exists. Now, there are several different problems that have been shown to be NP complete. SAT was the first NP complete problem, and it is one of the most commonly used when proving that some other problem is NP complete. How do you prove that, suppose you come up with a new problem or you identified some new problem, how do you prove it is NP complete? You take an existing NP complete problem and reduce the NP complete problem to your problem, not the other way around. You can always take an easy problem and reformulate it as a difficult problem, right? And that proves nothing about how easy or tough your problem is. You need to start with an NP complete problem and reduce it to your problem. So SAT is commonly used in that sense to, from a theoretical perspective, to show that many of the problems that we encounter in computing are NP complete. The NP completeness of SAT was first was first suggested by Stephen Cook in 1971. So with that brief conceptual background, let's dive into the SAT problem itself, how it is represented, and we'll look at several techniques or the various techniques that are used to solve SAT. So the Boolean formula is represented in conjunctive normal form. So conjunctive normal form is nothing but product of sums. So you have a bunch of these sum terms which are all ANDed together. Each sum term consists of some subset of the variables, either in complemented or uncomplemented form. Without loss of generality, you can say that a variable should not repeat in any form, right? Because if you have A plus, for example, if you have A plus B, you can simplify that and just rewrite it as A plus B and nothing changes, right? So you can pre-process any repeated occurrences of a variable. If you have A plus A prime plus B, that clause can be thrown away because A plus A prime is 1. Always, it doesn't matter what value you assign to A or any of the variables for that matter, this clause is always going to be satisfied. It's a useless clause. Throw it away. Focus on the rest of the clauses. Right? So, you will not have repetition of the same clause. Repetition of the same variable within a single clause. But, you can have variables appearing across as many clauses as you want. Each clause can have as many literals up to n, where n is the number of variables involved in the formula. Right? So this is the conjunctive normal form. In contrast with the circuit representation, right, a network of gates, what is different in the CNF representation is that logic circuits have structural information and they also have directional information. The direction of how electrical signals flow. What are the inputs? What are the outputs? That information is there. When you transform a circuit to a CNF formula, we've seen how that can be done, right? Remember when we talked about different representations of Boolean functions, we talked about the Satin transformation where you could take a logic circuit, for example, something like this, and encode each of the gates in the circuit as a bunch of clauses or as a bunch of sum terms, and then essentially take the conjunction of the sum terms that you derive from each of the gates, and that gives you a formula that is directly proportional in size to the circuit you started off with, right? You can do that. However, in doing so, it is not easy to tell by looking at this formula as to which of these variables is the output of the gate and which variable is the input of a gate. If I just gave you this formula without the logic circuit, it is not easy to tell. In fact, every circuit can be transformed into a corresponding CNF formula, but it's not every valid combinational circuit has an equivalent CNF formula representation, but it's not necessary that every CNF formula has an equivalent circuit representation. Okay. There are some special cases of SAT. In particular, if you impose a limit on the number of literals that can appear in a clause, if you limit that to K, that is known as the K-SAT problem. And what is interesting is that even 3-SAT, that is, even if you limit the number of literals per clause to at most three variables can be involved in each clause, even then the problem still remains NP-complete. 2-SAT is very easily solvable in polynomial time. When you go from 2 to 3, it becomes NP-complete and, of course, stays NP-complete after that. Okay. So some terminology which we are probably familiar with, but just to be sure that we're all on the same page. The sum term is also known as a clause. Appearance of a variable in the uncomplemented form is called a positive literal. And appearance of a variable in the complemented form is called a negative literal. Right? So now a CNF formula is nothing but a set of clauses. And each clause is the disjunction of or the logical OR of a bunch of positive literals and a bunch of negative literals. Why do we care about SAT? Apart from the theoretical importance that I already talked about, practically, it's used as a computational engine in several domains. Many AI applications, artificial intelligence applications, use SAT as a code engine. Of course, we are concerned in this course because SAT is used to solve many important EDA problems. We've already talked about some of them. Automatic test pattern generation of test patterns for manufacturing test. Verification, showing that two different versions of the circuit are functionally the same. SAT can also be used to perform timing analysis. We've talked about timing analysis in the context of the false path problem, right? Some paths in a circuit can never propagate events. You would like to find the longest true path in a circuit, or the longest path that can actually propagate a valid event. Power analysis, and so on and so forth. So there's various applications for SAT in the context of EDA, which make it quite important. A couple of examples. ATPG, we've talked about this before. In order to generate tests that you can use to ensure that the circuits that are coming off your manufacturing line are operating correctly, we generate these tests assuming a certain fault model. One of the most commonly used fault models in practice is the Stuckart fault model, where you take every wire in the circuit and say that that wire may be stuck at 0 or stuck at 1, and you generate a vector that will distinguish a fault-free circuit from a faulty circuit in the presence of that fault. Right, and a set of vectors that detects all possible Stuckart faults in the circuit is a test set that you can apply for manufacturing test. Okay, so what you do essentially is, effectively in ATPG logically, you construct this circuit known as a MITRE, which is consists of two different copies of the circuit. Right, you're not making two copies of the circuit in physical hardware. This is just an abstraction for the purpose of generating the test pattern. You have one copy of the circuit which does not have the fault. The other copy of the circuit has the fault, and of course the inputs to the two circuits are the same. The same variables are fed to the two circuits, and you have two different outputs, one in the fault-free case and the other in the faulty case, and you take the XOR of the two outputs. And this variable G, you ask the question, can this variable G ever be set to 1? What will it take to make this variable 1? The output of an XOR gate is 1 only if the inputs are different. You have a 0, 1 or 1, 0. So what does it mean for the inputs to be different? It means effectively that the input vector causes a different response at the output of the circuit based on whether the fault is present or not. Therefore, it's a valid test vector. Right? So if you solve this satisfiability problem, why is this a satisfiability problem? Take this MITRE circuit, use the Drayton transformation. This can be represented as a CNF formula, right? So represent this as a CNF formula. For each of these gates, you will have a bunch of clauses, and at the end of it, add a separate clause which just has one literal, G, in the positive form, right? What that'll, and try to find assignment to the variables that satisfies that entire formula. Since you have that unit clause, a clause with only one variable, the only way of satisfying that clause, remember, satisfying the formula requires that each and every clause be satisfied. You're taking the logical AND of the clauses. How can you satisfy a clause with only one variable? You have to set that variable to that value. So if you have a single clause with just G, then G will be forced to 1. And then the SAT solver will search for consistent values or assignments of all the other variables that make G equal to 1. Okay? So that's how you can encode or formulate the ATPG problem in terms of SAT. Verification is very similar. You have two circuits, A and B, maybe two different versions of the same circuit. You think that they should be equivalent, but you're not sure. You'd like to verify. Each circuit has multiple inputs or primary inputs and multiple outputs called primary outputs. You have the two circuits. You take the corresponding outputs, which are supposed to be the same, XOR them, and since you may have multiple outputs, you do the same for each and every one of the output pairs, right? So if the circuit has 10 outputs, you take the first output from circuit from copy A and the first output from copy B, which are supposed to be equivalent, take the XOR of them and do the same thing for each of the 10 outputs, and then take the OR of the output of all those XOR gates, right? And so essentially you ask the question, can the output of this OR gate ever be 1? For the output of the OR gate to be 1, at least one of its inputs should be 1, which in turn implies that at least one of the outputs of these two circuits should be different. And you search for an input assignment to the input variables that can make this 1. If you find that assignment, what does it mean? If you successfully find an assignment that sets the output of the OR gate to 1, it means that the circuits are not equivalent. There's a bug. If they're supposed to be equivalent, there's the bug somewhere. If not, if they are equivalent, you should be able to prove that no possible assignment of input values can ever make the output to be 1. In other words, the function, setting this variable to 1 is unsatisfiable. Right? Again, you formulate it as a CNF formula in the same way. Convert this whole circuit using the Satan transformation into a CNF formula with clauses for each of the gates, and add one single clause setting the output of the XOR, of the OR gate to a 1. Right? And if the SAT solver comes back and tells you this is an unsatisfiable formula, then you know that your two original two circuits are equivalent. Okay. Now let's, so hopefully, you know, we have a sense of the importance of SAT, both as a fundamental problem in computer science and as a core engine in many design automation tools. We will, in this lecture, as well as the next 1.5 to 2 lectures, be looking at different techniques that are used to solve the SAT problem. Okay? And the way we will approach this is to sort of take a historical view and progress forward through time. So this is the timeline that I'll be using. Okay, and so essentially we'll start off with the very earliest SAT solvers and make our way to some of the most recent and most efficient SAT solvers that there are out there. Okay, and along the way, hopefully some of the key concepts that have been introduced by and the significant developments will be highlighted. Okay, so the first, which is largely of historical perspective, the first known effort perhaps to construct a SAT solver goes back way beyond computers, right? It goes back to 1869, where a gentleman by the name of William Stanley Jevons tried to build a machine called the logic machine, and he published a couple of short book and a paper describing his work. So his objective in building, and this was a mechanical machine, you know, it consisted of various input keys, looked like sort of like a piano, various input keys using which you could key in the different logical propositions or the different premises that you would want to give as an input. And the objective, he was not trying to solve SAT, right? His objective was, given a set of logical statements, can you automatically, mechanically infer all possible other logical statements that can be derived from these logical statements? Right, that was what he was trying to do. But essentially, if you think about it, it is the same problem as SAT. Okay. So, he was, essentially he called his machine a reasoning machine. And it was based on a principle of substitution of similars. That's how it actually worked. And he demonstrated it actually working before the Royal Society of London in 1870. Jevons, interestingly, is better known for his contributions in a completely different field. Okay. He was one of the few people, by the way, to on a side note, to follow up on Boole's work before it was lost for, you know, several decades or almost a century, right? As we know. He was better known for his contributions to economics and notably the marginal utility theory, which is a very, very well-known principle in economics. And interestingly, somebody has taken the effort to reprint his book, and if you would like, it's actually available for purchase. Okay, getting a little more serious, Quine, in 1952, again, although he didn't really think of solving the SAT problem, right, when he proposed his Quine-McCluskey, the initial version of the Quine-McCluskey method, in particular when he proposed iterated consensus, actually was indirectly solving the SAT problem. So, in a sense, you know, 1870, so about 80 years later, the next known effort at solving SAT could be attributed to Quine. Why so? Recall iterated consensus? Starting with any cover of a function, any bunch of cubes, you generate all possible prime implicants, right? It turns out that iterated consensus can actually be used to check the tautology of a sum of products. It can be used to check whether a sum of products expression is a tautology. Why? Because for a tautology, the only prime, there's only one possible prime. The tautology cube or one, right? There's only one prime because all the, for a tautology, all the minterms, all the 2 power n minterms are in the onset. So there's only one cube that includes all of them. That's a prime. It has only one prime. So iterator consensus generates all primes. So when you keep generating all primes, you should end up with only one. Okay? So if the function you start off with is a tautology. So iterator consensus is really a tautology checking procedure. And remember that tautology checking is the dual of the satisfiability problem. Right? Tautology checking on DNF is actually the dual of satisfiability checking on CNF. DNF, remember, DNF is nothing but sum of products, CNF is product of sums. And therefore, it indirectly also becomes a SAT checking procedure. Let's look at an example. Here are two different CNF formulae, two different examples. Okay. How can you use iterated consensus to check satisfiability of these formulae? First thing you do is construct the DNF for the complement. Remember that using De Morgan's theorem, or De Morgan's rules, you can actually take a function represented in product of sums form. If this is f, you can write f prime in sum of product form directly, right? Take each of these sum terms, turn it into a product term, complement all the variables. So it's a direct one-to-one transformation. So you have a plus b plus c turns into a prime, b prime, c prime. B or c prime or f prime turns into b prime, c f. So take the same variables, take the AND of them, complement each of them, and take the disjunction of those terms, right? So each clause here becomes one product term. So we've done the same thing for the other CNF formula on the right. So start off with the DNF for the complement of the function. And what does iterator consensus do? You take pairs of cubes, compute the consensus between them, right? Remember, the only interesting case of consensus is when the distance between the cubes is 1, right? If the distance between the cubes is 1, then the consensus can potentially generate a cube that may be a prime. Okay? So, for instance, in this case, if you start with A prime, B prime, C prime, and B prime, C F, what is the consensus? What is the distance between these two? The distance is 1 because you have C prime here and C in the other one. Right? That is the only literal on which they differ. One has the uncomplemented, the other has the complemented form. And the consensus of the two is A prime, B prime, F. Similarly, consensus of the first and the third cubes gives you A prime, C prime, E. Now, similarly, the consensus of the second and the third cubes gives C, F, E prime. So, by taking consensus of all 3C2 combinations of the first three cubes, you get these three new cubes that you add to the expression. It doesn't change the expression itself, functionally. Now, again, take the consensus of pairs of cubes, of the original cubes and the new cubes that you generated through the first round. And if you see the first and first cube and the fourth cube, you'll get A prime, B prime, which contains the first two, so you can get rid of them, and so on and so forth. Okay? So as you generate the consensus, eventually you converge, and you see that no more implicants are generated. Iterated consensus has converged because you cannot, taking consensus of all pairs of cubes that remain will not give you any new cube that will survive the single cube containment process. So at this point, you have not seen the one cube, therefore this is not a tautology. If this is not a tautology, f prime is not a tautology, it means that original f is not the constant zero. So original f is satisfiable. Right. For the other example, if you go through the same process, you see that the first two terms generate A prime, get rid of them. These two generate A, get rid of them. Consensus of A and A prime is 1. So you have generated the one cube. So this is a tautology. And that means that the complement of this function is a constant zero, which is unsatisfiable. The next development in SAT came in 1960, courtesy of Davis and Putnam. Okay. And their technique was basically known as resolution. Along with the techniques, I'm also showing on the timeline roughly the size of the problems that could be solved using these techniques at the time they were proposed. Okay, so this is not a real apples to apples comparison. Because the computers that are available at this time and the computers that are available at this time are not of the same speed. Okay, so these were the, nevertheless, gives you a feel for the scalability of the algorithm. Okay, resolution of a pair of clauses with exactly one incompatible variable is defined as follows. So here's a pair of clauses. This is one clause. This is a different clause. These clauses have exactly one incompatible variable, which means one variable where you have the complemented form in one clause and uncomplemented in the other, right? So C prime and C. So you immediately see the analogy to consensus of cubes. In cubes, we said you need a distance of one. What does the distance of one mean? You have complemented in one and uncomplemented in the other. Similarly here, one incompatible variable between the two clauses. And what you do to generate the the resolution of these two clauses is a third clause, which you can add to the CNF formula. Suppose you had a CNF formula that consists of these two clauses. Without changing the function, without changing the satisfiability of the formula, maintaining the equivalence, you can add a third clause by essentially copying all the other variables apart from the conflicting variable. Okay, so you have A plus B here, copy it down, you had G plus H prime, copy it down, and you have F, so copy it down as well. So this is a new clause that you can construct from the side variables, other than the conflicting variable, that you can add to the CNF formula without changing it. Okay? So that is the basis of this procedure called resolution. So hopefully you've seen in a sense that resolution is the dual of consensus. It's basically, and consensus operates on cubes, resolution operates on disjuncts or some terms, and it operates in a similar manner because you take the variable that is conflicting and remove it and keep all the other variables. So the Davis-Putnam algorithm worked as follows. Starting with a CNF formula, iteratively pick a variable for resolution and keep computing the resolution of all pairs of clauses in the CNF formula with respect to that variable until no more variables are left. And you can discard original clauses once you computed the resolution. So, to explain, suppose you start off with the CNF formula as that's shown here, A plus B plus C, and B plus C prime plus F prime, and B prime plus E. Now, suppose you pick the variable B to compute the resolution. So now you'll have some clauses which have B in positive form, other clauses that have B in negative form. So now take each of the positive clauses and each of the negative clauses. So for all these combinations, pairs, you now need to compute a resolution clause. Okay? So in this case, you have two positive clauses and one negative clause. So you have two resolution clauses. From the first and the third clause, you compute, take all the side variables, A, C, and E. So you have A plus C plus E. Similarly, from the second and third clause, compute C prime plus F prime plus E. C prime plus F prime plus E. So these are your two resolution clauses that you computed by looking at the variable B. Similarly, now look at the variable C among these clauses. Okay. So now you can forget about the original clauses. Take these clauses. Look at the variable C. You have C appearing in positive form here and negative form here. So compute the resolution with respect to C of these two clauses. That gives you A plus E plus F prime. And now you can say this is satisfiable because essentially by setting A to 1 or by setting E to 1 or by setting F to 0, you can satisfy this clause. Okay. On the other hand, you start off with A plus B, a different formula, A plus B into A plus B prime and so on. Here if you compute the resolution with respect to B, you see that you have one clause with B and another with B prime. So if you take the resolution, that gives you A. Next, now you cannot get rid of these clauses because you've not computed the resolution yet. So you can only delete clauses once you compute the resolution. These clauses have to remain. Now if you compute the resolution of with the remaining clauses 1, 2, 3 with respect to variable, you just copy the clauses over. So this is at the end of round 1 of resolution, this is your new CNF formula. Now if you compute the resolution with respect to variable A, you compute the resolution of the first and third clause, first and second clause as C, and the first and third clause as C prime. But this C and C prime, you know, is zero. So this is unsat. So as you keep computing the resolution, if the formula is unsatisfiable, you will get a variable and its complement eventually ANDed together and unsat. Now, this looks like a relatively simple procedure and it looks like an efficient process, right? However, there's a potential memory explosion problem here. Computing resolution is very easy, right? But of course, this cannot be polynomial time. I've already told you that SAT is NP-complete. If not, we would have solved a very major problem here, right? So, what gives? Where is the complexity hidden in this process? The number of clauses in the first place could be large. Sure. Sure. How about the number of clauses? So suppose the number of clauses you start off with initially is not large. I suppose I even give you that. Right? It's larger than the number of variables, but it's not exponential in the number of variables. What can still happen? Remember, in how many resolution clauses can you have? In the worst case, you have, let's say you start with m original clauses, m by 2 of them will have variable in positive form, m by 2 in negative form, and it's m by 2 multiplied by m by 2, m square. Again, you can be squaring the number of clauses. So, in this case, of course, I picked examples that fit on a single slide, so they actually, the number of clauses reduces and, you know, these cases work efficiently. But in general, these intermediate expressions that you have, the number of clauses can actually keep expanding, since every step can potentially quadratically increase the size of the CNF formula. Right? So Davis and Putnam's technique spurred another set of researchers. Davis was, of course, common to both. Davis, Logman, and Loveland, to propose a new algorithm in 1962, which is really remains today, like the Quine-McCluskey algorithm remains the workhorse of exact two-level minimizers, the DLL algorithm, or sometimes also referred to as the DPLL algorithm, because it sort of combines the DP and the DLL. This is used as the workhorse of most modern SAT solvers today. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about, for a few minutes, about DPLL and then stop. So how does the DLL algorithm was proposed, as I mentioned, by Davis, Logman, and Loveland. It's the basic framework for modern SAT solvers, also known as DPLL, because the DP algorithm and the DLL algorithms are sort of proposed very close to each other, and, you know, they have the D in common. So the basic concept in DPLL is to perform a depth-first search on the search tree. Remember, the search tree, if you have a bunch of clauses like this, with, in this case, four variables, you can represent the possible assignments to all the variables as a search tree, right? Combinations of A equals 0 or 1, B equals 0 or 1, and so on. So, of course, you don't want to construct the entire search tree up front, right? Like we did not want to do in two-level minimization. Similarly here, you do not want to construct the search tree. Instead, what the DPLL procedure does effectively is, it explores the search tree in a depth-first manner. Okay. We'll see how that works. You start off with a CNF formula, initially pick a variable, and make a decision on the value of the variable. Okay. So the initial decision that you make is something that, you know, you're just taking a guess. You'd like to explore what if A were 0. What happens if A were 0? You immediately reflect the decision, impact of the decision, on the CNF formula. When you set A to 0, some clauses become satisfied. Whenever you have A prime, the clauses get satisfied. So I just change the color in the animation to green, indicating that these clauses are now satisfied. You don't need to worry about down this subtree that, you know, is rooted from this point onwards. You only need to worry about satisfying the remaining clauses. You don't need to worry about the green clauses. Okay? So that's a decision. You take a decision on a variable. If you still have unsatisfied clauses left, you make a decision on another variable. In this case, let's say we pick B and set B to 0. Now you also see that the clause with B prime has been satisfied. So next, what you do is similarly pick C and set C to 0. So that now satisfies two more clauses and you have two clauses left. Now you could do one of a couple of things. You could explore D as a decision variable, Okay, that's one possibility. You can explore both cases of D. But if you did that, that would amount to exhaustively exploring the search tree. Okay? And that, you know, we know is not going to be very efficient, right? Because there is exponential number of combinations. Instead, what you do is you take the clauses that involve variables A, C, and D and construct what is known as an implication graph. Okay? So without considering whether, D equals 0 and D equals 1, without considering the two cases there, if you look at the two remaining clauses that you have at this point, after you reflect the three decisions, A equals 0, B equals 0, C equals 0, you know that all the green clauses have been satisfied, the two clauses that remain have not been satisfied. Use these unsatisfied clauses to construct what is known as a conflict graph. What does the conflict graph have? Well, the vertices of the conflict graph are some of the decisions you've already taken. You've taken a decision A equals 0, so you have a vertex A equals 0. You've taken a decision C equals 0, you have a vertex C equals 0. You might also have a vertex B equals 0. In this case, we don't need it for reasons that will become apparent soon. But you look at these decisions that you've taken and you derive implications of these decisions on other variables that you have not yet made decisions on. So currently you made decisions on A, B, C, but not made a decision on D. However, if you look at A equals 0 and C equals 0, by analyzing the first clause, A plus C plus D, you can say that once A is 0 and C is 0, the only way of satisfying this clause is for D equals 1. So the clause A plus C plus D causes an implication from A equals 0 and C equals 0 to this new vertex, which is a forced decision. These are free decisions. You chose to make them of your own will. But once you made these decisions, it forces you to set D equals 1. However, if you look at the second clause, which is unsatisfied, it is A plus C plus D prime. And what that does is that since you've already decided A equals 0 and C equals 0, it forces you to set D equals 0 also. You can never do both at the same time. This is known as a conflict. And what a conflict tells you is that at this point, you can stop searching in the subtree. You will not find any feasible solution down this path or this subtree. So rather than explore D equals 0 and D equals 1 cases separately, through deduction, through analysis of the effect of these decisions you made and constructing the implication graph, you found out that you cannot find a valid solution down this path anymore. So what you do is I'd say that at this point, I'm done. The formula is unsat down this path and you perform a step known as backtracking. This is similar to bound in branch and bound. Okay. It's not exactly the same. Branch and bound is an algorithm for optimization problems. This is the decision problem. It has only yes, no answer. You're not minimizing anything. You're just, saying, is the formula satisfiable or not? Okay. So it's an analogous algorithm. Here it's known as backtracking. So backtracking, all that it does is that it says, okay, since I cannot find a solution down C equals zero, I need to change something that I've assumed so far. Right? So, there are different ways of backtracking. The simplest way is to pick the last decision that you made and flip it. Let me try C equals 1. Now, it turns out if you try C equals 1, these two clauses shown in yellow here are unsatisfied. And if you construct the implication graph, again, you will find a conflict. Okay? The same way, you will simultaneously need to set D to both 0 and 1, which is not possible. So, now you backtrack. Since you considered both cases of 0 and 1 for C, you now need to backtrack at the higher level. And you make a forced decision at the level of B to set B to 1. Okay? Because you know that B equals 0 subtree contains no possible solution. So B has got to be 1. Now, then if you made a decision of C equals 0, again you will see that you have a conflict on D. Similarly, when you backtrack here, again, you will find a conflict on D. Now, you go back to the top level and backtrack. When you backtrack at A level, you set A to be 1. Make a decision on B to 0, and that satisfies a whole bunch of clauses as shown there. But at this point, you reach a conflict. Because if you analyze the unsatisfied clauses, you will see that the conflict now is on variable C. C needs to be both 0 and 1 simultaneously. So you backtrack again, forced decision. Here, if you keep, look at the implication graph, once you set A equals 1 and B equals 1, automatically you will see that C is forced to be 1. Why? Because you have this A prime or B prime or C, this last clause here. The moment you set A equals 1 and B equals 1, in order to satisfy this clause shown here, C has got to be 1. And therefore, you can automatically reflect C equals 1, which is a implication of the previous decisions that you made, right? You don't need to branch on C. You know that C has got to be 1 down this path, and you force C to be 1. Now, interestingly, if you set B equals 1 and C equals 1, and look at this clause that remains, that forces D to be 1, right? Because B prime and C prime are both 0, the only way this clause can be satisfied is B has to be 1. And then, if you actually make that assignment, it turns out that everything is satisfied and you're done. Okay? So, in the worst case, you will still explore 2 to the n possible leaves of the search tree. But hopefully in practice, you explore only a small part of the search tree and you find a satisfying solution. Or sometimes you can even prove the formula to be unsatisfiable if you terminate, if you find conflicts at earlier levels of the search tree and you exhaust the search space in that way. So that is, in a nutshell, how the DPLL procedure works. I'm going to quickly review this in the beginning of the next lecture and continue from there onwards. But if you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them now on DPLL.